I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. Our guest today is Marcus J. Moore. Marcus is the author of the Stacks Book Club November pick, The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. We talk today with Marcus about why he wanted to tell Kendrick Lamar's story now, his career in music writing, and Marcus gives us some recommendations on music we should definitely be listening to. Don't worry, there are no spoilers on today's episode. Great news, The Stacks finally has merch, and you can get yourself some of our super cute gear by going to thestackspodcast.com/shop. Also, anyone who joins The Stacks Pack in November gets a free audiobook from our friends over at Libro FM. And that's in addition to the 2-for-1 deal that they offer for any listener of the show when they use the code THESTACKS at checkout. If you want to join the Stacks Pack, head to patreon.com/thestacks. I also always like to say an extra special thank you to our newest members of the Stacks Pack. This week, that includes Sonia Chen, Maggie, Laura Marquez, Amelia Lewis, Stephanie Cristione, Alicia Monroe, Valerie Berezin, Cindy Allman, Jamie Moore, and Alice Shanklin. Thank you all so much. And now, without further ado, let's get to my conversation that is spoiler-free with Marcus J. Moore. All right, everybody. I'm very excited. Today, I am here with Marcus J. Moore. Marcus is the author of our November book club pick, The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. Marcus, welcome to The Stacks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm so thrilled to have you. I'm thrilled to be discussing this book with you today. It's something that we have not done on the podcast. We've never done a music biography. I actually don't think we've done we did the autobiography of Malcolm X, but I don't think we've done anyone else's biography. So this is exciting for the show. And we always start here in about 30 seconds or so. Can you just tell us about your book?
Yes. The Butterfly Effect is a book about Kendrick Lamar. It's a culture biography that talks about his upbringing and his music, but it also talks about Black culture as a whole and how he affected it.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting mix of lyrical analysis and then cultural analysis and a biography. And it has a lot of different layers, which I think is really cool, especially for a book about someone who's not only alive, but super young still. Like Kendrick Lamar's not even 35. He's a young dude. And, you know, as far as music goes, he's put out some incredible albums, but even that, like not so many. So I'm curious why you felt compelled to write his story now?
Well, a few different reasons. One, first and foremost, I just wanted to give flowers, you know, like as corny and as cliche as that sounds, I feel like, especially when you're talking about Black art, there's always this notion of, oh, you know, you have to wait until the person gets older or sadly they pass away and then you look back at their career. And this year, especially, even though I turned in the book last year, but for that same reason, you know, in terms of like giving the flowers early, you know, after I submitted the book, like Kobe Bryant passed away. Pop Smoke died. Chadwick Boseman died. And so there's, you know, so it's always this like, then they pass away. Then we look back and we're sad. But I'm like, well, I feel like we need to be celebrating people while they're alive. And I don't, maybe I'm just one of those mushy people where tell, you know, you got to tell your friends how great they are. Because we all have moments where you don't feel so great. You know, you don't feel like what you're doing is valuable. I'm not saying that Kendrick felt that way, but just as a Black man, just as a Black author, a Black writer, I always want to celebrate music and art that may be a little bit off the beaten path. But with Kendrick, you know, we all know how great he is, but at the same time, he needed to be sort of canonized in literature form because, you know, when you look at other books, you can read a Bruce Springsteen book a million times. You can read the same Bob Dylan book a million times, but like there's a whole generation of talent similar to Kendrick's where they deserve a book too. And so that's what I wanted to do with him is just sort of celebrate this recent history.
Okay, so that reminds me of something. I'm going to kind of jump off. We'll come right back to this. But I don't know if you know that we're doing the book with Cole Kushner on the podcast. And I don't know if you're familiar with Cole's work, but he has a podcast called Dissect. And he's done two Kendrick Lamar albums. And when I asked him specifically about why he does hip hop albums, he said a very similar thing, which was, you know, you could hear someone dissect a Beatles album a million times or Radiohead a million times. And he's like, I love Radiohead. They're my favorite band. But I wanted to lend my background as a music person, as someone that, you know, is quote unquote taken seriously or whatever that means to this incredible Black art that often we're not seeing dissected or talked about. And it did make me think about Kendrick Lamar because there's a few Kendrick Lamar songs that I just love. Like I think Humble is so good. It's a bop. Like it's just such a great song, but I don't feel like I ever really understood how great Kendrick Lamar was as an artist and as a creative until I listened to Cole's work and until I read your book and I started thinking about what he was doing in space and time. And so I think the work that you do is really important because I'm someone who loves hip hop and I listen to hip hop, but I don't even always understand what I'm listening to unless someone's telling me like, hey, this is important. Pay attention, you know? So I just think that that's really cool that both of you have now said this as part of the reason that you chose Kendrick Lamar and why you do the work that you do. I'm interested in how you researched for this book and if you talked to the very private illustrious Kendrick Lamar for the book.
Yeah, no. He and TDE were the first email/call that I made. But I knew early on in 2018 when the deal was locked in that I wasn't going to get them because they're always in album mode. And when they're in album mode, they lock in and they don't talk to anybody. Like it's nothing personal. It's just that's how they are. And so they totally know about the book. They knew about it first and foremost, but I didn't get an opportunity to speak with them. But they also did a really cool thing indirectly where, you know, I've heard horror stories of this, you know, this person wants to write a book about, you know, whatever artist, whoever that may be. And then they may go out there publicly and say, hey, you know, you're going to hear from this writer. Don't talk to him. They didn't do that. Right. It's very rare that happens. But okay. I've heard that happen before. And so they didn't do that with me. Like I knew pretty early on that I wasn't going to talk to them. But then they just kind of backed up and was like, you know, I would hope that once you reach that level of fame that you know who's writing about you. I would hope that maybe they did their Googles and they were like, okay, well, this isn't just any old body writing. So we're intrigued to see what he comes up with.
Yeah. I was just going to say, for people who haven't read the book yet, can you just say who slash what TDE is? Because they're going to be like, I don't know what that means.
Yes, TDE. I'm sorry. Yeah. TDE, that's Top Dog Entertainment. That is the label that Kendrick is on.
Okay, perfect. Just in case, it's in the book. You talk about them a ton in the book. But for people, I'm assuming some of y'all haven't read the book yet because you are last minute people like me and you're waiting till this week to read it because we're going to talk about it next week. But you did talk to a lot of people who work in and around and were part of, I mean, most of the book focuses on To Pimp a Butterfly. I would say like a good, I don't know, 60%, 70% of the book. Like it's sort of around at least the musical analysis part of it, certainly. So you did get to talk to some people. Were there things that people told you about Kendrick Lamar that you were surprised to hear about him? Or were there things where you were like, wow, I didn't know he does that? Or that's so not what I had imagined of him or anything like that?
Yeah, the thing that surprised me the most is, you know, before this book and before talking to people and going to different interviews where like people like Soundwave and Ali were talking, I just kind of equated Kendrick Lamar as a rapper, as a lyricist. You know, he goes in there, he likes the beat, he raps, he goes home. I didn't realize until researching this book that he's a producer. Like he's into every facet of the music. So he's not only writing his own music, he sat in on Kendrick Lamar, Kamasi Washington laying out the string parts. He knows how to construct the beat to tailor it to what he wants to do. So instead of just a straightforward beat, he knows like, okay, right here, I'm going to slow this down. I'm going to tweak my voice here. I'm going to, you know, bring in a totally different beat. And then here's where Rhapsody is going to rap. You know, it's different things like that, that I didn't realize that he's essentially a jazz musician in a rapper's body. Like Robert Glasper told me that, and Terrace Martin told me that, where he's no different than somebody like a Herbie Hancock or a Pharoah Sanders, who, even though they play this one instrument, they're conducting this whole thing. And so, you know, whereas To Pimp a Butterfly is a straight up jazz album, the album after that, Damn, is its own form of jazz. It's like a spiritual jazz album because it has so many different moving parts. And so me as a jazz head, that's the thing that made me light up. Like, oh, wait, he's a jazz dude? And then when you go back and you listen to his music and listen to the way his albums are constructed, you totally see what they're talking about. So that was the most surprising thing, just from a musical standpoint.
Right. And you're a music writer. That's your other job aside for being an author now, which is exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I've heard you talk a little bit about how you were introduced to music. And I think you write about it maybe in the acknowledgments of your book, just from family. And you kind of were like an MTV generation kind of kid, like sitting in front of the TV, just like watching music and listening to music. So I'm curious kind of when you were like, yo, this is something I can actually make a job, even if I'm not creating the music, like even if I'm not a rapper or a pianist or whatever, like how did you figure out like I can be a music person?
I can tell you the specific day. It was it was 2008. It was 2008. At the time, I was a education reporter covering Montgomery County education and politics in the DC suburbs of Montgomery County, Maryland. At the time, I had been covering education for 4 years, and it was a cool enough job. I learned a lot. But I was sitting in a school board meeting one day, and I literally said under my breath, I can't do this anymore. I just, because it was some crazy, like, you know, some, they were fighting about something, and it was just like, why am I covering this? This is nonsense. Like, I need to stop. And so from there, you know, I thought that to be a music writer, I needed to come out and be at Pitchfork or be at Rolling Stone or be at these big pubs right away. But then I realized like, well, if I'm not going to get these opportunities because I don't have any clips, let me just start my own thing. And so I set into motion my own website called DMV Spectrum, District, Maryland, Virginia Spectrum. And I just literally married my two loves. I knew how to write a little bit. I knew I loved music. And so I just started doing it. I was driving around DC. I was driving around Maryland, all parts of Virginia, just covering all the local music I could. And so that also set into motion this idea that, everybody's going to be covering the Kanyes and the Drakes and all these big names. I'm not going to get those assignments right now. So let me cover stuff that people ought to know about. Let me cover Go-Go. Let me cover the open mic scene in DC and somehow find a way to blow those artists up a little bit more, and in turn blowing myself up a little bit more as a guy who's always going to cover music that's, off the beaten path. So that's how I got into it. And then I just stuck with it. And from there it became a snowball. It was me reaching out to people. So, I did DMV Spectrum. That caught the attention of the Washington City paper. And then I started emailing like BBC Music, MTV, OK Player, all these different places. And thankfully, they saw enough in my work to bring me on. And then I just kept going. I just kept that hustle going.
I love that. The stories like that give people like me hope for my own future.
Yeah.
Just like figure it out as you go. If there's not space for you, create the space. God, I love that. That makes me so happy. I could use a little joy this week. For those of you at home, just so you know, we're recording this the Friday before the election. So you're listening to this after the election, but my headspace currently is 3 weeks ago for those of you listening at home. I just feel like we have to say it because it's such a weird time. And not that we talk about current events so much on this show, but sometimes we do. And then people are like, what? Like, that's like such old news. Okay. I want you to kind of do a soft pitch of your book to people who are listening to this podcast who maybe don't know a lot about Kendrick Lamar and are kind of like, why would I read this book? Tracy and Marcus, like I read literary fiction or whatever. I want you to kind of just explain to people why this book, what did, I mean, I'm going to follow up with why I think, but I'd love to hear what you think about this book kind of in the greater space of books at the moment.
Yeah, I feel like when people think about Kendrick Lamar, they think about just him as a lyricist and as a rapper. And sadly, there's a segment of this country that still doesn't view hip hop as music. They still don't view it as viable art. And what Kendrick Lamar has done over the past decade is take hip hop from this one space of, okay, it's just, something that black kids over here are doing, to this grand art that everybody should pay attention to because he won the Pulitzer Prize. And he is the first rapper to ever win the Pulitzer Prize. And so that alone, I feel like is worthy of praise and acknowledgement. But at the same time, as Kendrick Lamar is ascending in his career, America is descending in their history. And so the book is this intersection of, okay, Kendrick Lamar is dealing with survivor's guilt. He's dealing with depression. He's dealing with all these things that people in hip hop don't really acknowledge. They don't really talk about. And at the
Right.
same time, he's also informed by the killing of Trayvon Martin, the killing of Mike Brown, and Sandra Bland, and all of these people. And so the book is not a traditional biography. It's not a traditional celebrity biography. What it is it's a dissection of himself. It's also a dissection of America. And it discusses how he brought jazz back to the fore and all of these different things working in concert. And so what I think people should get from the book, or what I hope people get from the book, is that Black history is American history. And even though it's recent history, it's something that needs to be discussed, here in from this day forward.
Yes. I mean, all of that. I'm just going to add in another reason that if you're on the fence about this book or you're kind of like, what is this book, that I suggest that you read it, is that it's really good. Like the book is well done and it does kind of touch on those different parts, but also for people who like art or are curious about the ways that art function in society, this book does such a good job of kind of taking a tiny, like just one person's art and explaining and kind of blowing it up and explaining how that has ripples throughout the society in a really interesting way. So it's a book about Kendrick Lamar, but it's also a book about kind of the relationship, as you're saying, between art and America and art and history, and specifically, you know, Kendrick, specifically Black art, but also just in general, how those things work together. I have a question that it might just be a me question, but I'm going to ask it because I have a me podcast.
Do it.
I need to know why you didn't spend more time on Damn, because that is the album arguably that made Kendrick, you know, high art, right? Because he won the Pulitzer for Damn. So I'm curious, because Damn doesn't even come up until like the second to last chapter, I don't think. Or the last chapter. And then same with the Black Panther soundtrack, which is different. But Damn really is like, I think, you know, in his obituary, it will say one day, hopefully 90 years from now, Kendrick Lamar, Pulitzer Prize winner for the album Damn. So I'm curious why that album didn't get as much play in the book.
No, that's fair. I feel like by the time he was creating Damn, he started to be a lot more reclusive than he was in years past. So even during the Butterfly days and during the Untitled and Mastered and Good Kid, Mad City, like he was a lot out there. He was out there much more in terms of discussing how the album was created, the impact and everything. And so, to be frank, I also knew what I was up against because I didn't get the opportunity to talk to TDE. So that was the time when I had to sort of rely, either I had to rely on previous information or I relied heavily on Terrace Martin. And I also had to put on my music critic hat a little bit more and say, like, here's what he's talking about. And admittedly, Damn is a lot more, it's a lot leaner than To Pimp a Butterfly. Whereas, you know, To Pimp a Butterfly was like this sort of quirky jazz record. Damn is a record for the club. But I didn't realize until I started dissecting that album again, that he's talking about some deep spirituality. You know, he's wrestling with the notion of God in his own life, not for everybody, but for himself.
Right.
And so, by the time, the reason why Damn is near the end of the book is because I also wanted to go in chronological order. I do realize that it's kind of Tarantino style, where it drops you into this crazy scene, that being the Macklemore debacle at the Grammys, and then it backs up, and then it walks you up to the Damn part. And so, when I listen to Damn these days, and even when I listened to it in 2017, it definitely felt like a sort of this victory lap in terms of, okay, I am Kendrick Lamar in all caps now. Here's my record. And, you know, I wanted to talk about how it won the Pulitzer and what that meant. But I also realized that these were leaner years for him, sort of vocally. You know, he wasn't really out there as much as he had been in previous years.
Right. I am one of the like five people, I think, who likes Damn more than To Pimp a Butterfly.
No, I have friends like that.
I know that everyone loves To Pimp a Butterfly. I mean, All Right to me is like, I don't know, maybe one of the greatest songs ever. I think All Right is just an incredible song. It's just because it's a bop, but it's also like a legit heavy hitting lyrical song. Mm-hmm. But to me, Damn, Love is like, I love Love so much.
Yeah.
I was a spin instructor, and so also I think some of it is informed by like what songs I like to ride to, and that is one of the songs I just loved riding to. Love, I know it's a weird song to spin to, but anyways, but your favorite is To Pimp a Butterfly, or are you a Good Kid, Mad City person? What's your favorite Kendrick?
Oh no, To Pimp a Butterfly all day. I'm a jazz head, like
right.
I'm talking,
I know that,
like, deep crates, yeah. So that's my joint.
Okay, here we go. This is, I'm very curious about this because you've been, you know, deep in the Kendrick biography world. What do you, if you had to pick one of Kendrick Lamar's most important contributions to the culture, what would you pick?
I would pick his honesty, because, you know, I grew up on hip hop, and I grew up in an era of hip hop where, you know, it was in the 80s. When you had people like groups like Boogie Down Productions, you had Public Enemy. And then when you had like MC Light, you had Queen Latifah, all these people where they had no problem being honest in their work. They had no problem talking about what was going on, especially in the case of Boogie Down Productions. You know, they had an album, KRS-One had an album called Edutainment, you know, and it was literally just him teaching the whole time, Public Enemy, Fight the Power, you know. So I grew up on stuff like that. But I feel like when Kendrick came of age, music, hip hop had stopped doing that. We were very celebratory. Like we were, Right. Maybe it was because of the Obama years, but everybody was in the club. Everybody was popping a bottle. And that's cool. I'm not the old fogey dude where it's like, oh no, no, this is back in my day. No, I'm never going to be one of those people. But I do feel like it was pretty celebratory. The beats were a lot glossier.
Right.
But the thing about Kendrick that I've always appreciated, that I think is his biggest contribution, is that, again, like we were talking about earlier, he's talking about the trappings of fame. He's talking about, okay, I'm rich now. How do I pay taxes? I'm on tour, but I want to be in Compton. I contemplated suicide. You know, all of these different things that
Right. Rappers
will not talk about, because once you get to that level of success, there's this notion that you have a brand now and you have a brand to protect. And he doesn't do that. And he still doesn't do that. You know, like we were saying earlier, even with Damn, he's talking about God. He's talking about spirituality. He's talking about, the last song is about how him, his dad and Top had this chance encounter at a KFC that Top was about to rob. You know, it's crazy stuff like that, that I feel like has gotten back to the foundation of hip hop that a lot of rappers have gotten away from. He's reminding us that hip hop is definitely about stories. It's about narratives, because he doesn't want to make music that is just popular right now. He wants to make music that will last 10 years, 20 years, and will have books written about it. So I think that's what he brings to the culture more than anything else.
Yeah, I love that. You know what? Do you know who I'm always reminded of? Are you a sports person?
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't he sort of, like, his weird reclusiveness, isn't it sort of like Kawhi Leonard?
All day.
The like, Claw. Is that just because they're both from, like, L.A.? What is that about? Why are they both weird like that?
That is a good question. That is a really good question. Yeah, maybe it's an L.A. thing. I never thought about it like that, yeah.
I just always, they're both, like, inextricably linked in my mind. And it just is now dawning on me that it's because they're both sort of, like, weird recluse. Artisty people, even though, you know, Kawhi's not, I guess, an artist, but whatever. That same kind of vibe, like two friends, weird.
That's true.
But like great. That. Weird and great. Okay. We have to talk about the cover of the book because it is so gorgeous. And I know most authors are like, I didn't have anything to do with it, but do you have anything to do with this cover? How did it come to be? Talk to me about it.
Yeah. I had something to do with that because I wanted it to feel like its own piece of art. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, anytime we're talking about Kendrick Lamar, obviously we talk about the art and we talk about how gorgeous the art is, you know, the music itself, the beats. And I also knew that it wasn't a, you know, again, it's not a traditional biography. You know, it's almost like notes to Kendrick, you know, that kind of thing. Notes about TDE. And so I wanted it to look like handwriting, you know, that's not my handwriting, but I wanted it to look like that. The photo, it was just, we got the rights to it and we wanted to make it look poetic in a way where he's, you know, looking contemplative off to the side. So that was definitely me saying like, hey, let's make this look like sort of a journal or notepad, because I knew that's how the book kind of comes off too. It's me meditating on a lot of different things.
Yeah. It's so gorgeous. Okay. We're going to take a quick break and then we will be right back. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're going to now transition a little bit more into you as a writer and your process and kind of how you wrote this book. So my first question is, if you were going to say, this is sort of like a first date question. Sure. If you were going to say that your writing was like a musician or an album, what would you compare it to?
I'm so glad you asked that question because I've been thinking about this for so long. And you're the first person to ask. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just as a music head, I liken my writing to Miles Davis in the 70s. Miles Davis from like 69 to 70. When, you know, before then, his music was quote unquote traditional as jazz can be, right? But in 1969, he comes out with this album In a Silent Way, where he goes electric for the first time. And in 1970, he comes out with Bitches Brew, which is like this brooding sort of electronic funk rock jazz album that changed the course of jazz music. So I've always likened my writing to that. It has a very conversational pace to it with everything that I write, but then it has these flares of like, oh wow, you know. So even with this book, chapter 5 is that, you know, chapters 1 through 4, I'm kind of walking you through, and then once you get to chapter 5, which is the fight for Black life, and it's just all Tamir Rice and Trayvon and Eric Garner, it shifts into this totally different direction. So that's what I've always likened it to. And when I was writing this book in particular, I was really taken by this album by this jazz drummer in Chicago named Micaiah McCraven. And he came out with an album called Universal Beings that has the same sort of leisurely pace, but it's a lot going on beneath just his subtle drum taps. And so that's what I would liken it to. That, and I would liken this, I would liken the book to like a universal, a weird mix of Universal Beings and Jean and Quelle Chris, Jean Grey and Quelle Chris's Everything's Fine album.
I don't know any of those albums, but I'm going to go listen. I do feel like you're very self-aware, because I would totally describe your book in those same terms that you use. And I feel like I talk to a lot of authors and sometimes they say things and I'm like, are we talking about the same book? So I feel like you really nailed that. I'm really impressed with that. Most people are not as self-aware with what they create, myself included. So that was awesome. Wow. Okay. This is another kind of music question. I always ask people this, but I'm the most curious based on you because of what you do. But what sort of stuff were you listening to while you were writing this book? Obviously, aside from any Kendrick Lamar music.
Oh, sure, sure. I was, I was listening to Mekhi McRaven's Universal Beings album, which I love and I still love. I was listening to Everything's Fine, which is a hip hop album by Jean Grey and Quelle Chris. I thought that was the best album of 2018. And I was also listening to a couple different albums. I was listening to Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life. And I was listening to this other jazz album called Wisdom of Elders by Shabaka and the Ancestors. And the reason why I was listening to those records is because, along with the subtlety and the nuance that they provide, which is what I always try to root my writing in nuance, you know, something that it's not going to beat you over the head, but for whatever reason, you find yourself coming back to it, like an old Raphael Sadiq song, you know? So I was listening to those records, but I also realized that this book wouldn't be anything without the people that are in it, you know, who are in it. And, much like Stevie's Songs in the Key of Life, where it's his name on the cover, when you look at the liner notes, you're like, oh, wow, Herbie Hancock is on this. Oh, man, Dizzy Gillespie played on this song, and George Benson. And all these names are, like, in it. Same thing with Everything's Fine, the Jean and Quelle record, where, yes, it's those two on the front, but, you know, you have Anna Wise that's all in there. You have, you know, Hannibal Buress, and, you know, they all come together in this creative community to create this one thing. And so I'm thankful with this. It relates to this book because, like, you know, I knew I wasn't going to talk to Kendrick. I wasn't going to talk to TDE, but Robert Glasper gave me time, and Terrace Martin, and all these different people, and Reggie Inge and Matt Jeezy. And so, yes, it's my name on the cover of the book, but it's essentially the literary form of Songs in the Key of Life, Everything's Fine, Universal Beings, where all of these people came together to help make the book, and I'm thankful for them. And so it kept me going back to those records.
Ah, I love that. Okay, the other part of that question, which I separated, which I don't normally do, is what sort of stuff were you reading and or watching while you were writing this book?
Yes, I was, admittedly, I didn't do a ton of reading, and here's why. I have a very good reason. my friends are too good. Like, I didn't want to be psyched out. Like, I had the Tribe Called Quest of Hanif joint. I kept staring at it. I was like, man, I really need to read that. But he's so good that I was just like, I don't want to read it. And then I go back to mine, and I'm like, man, I don't even like my book anymore. And like, Jason Green's book about the memoir about his daughter passing away. I had that that I had. And then obviously, like, literally every Jason Reynolds book. I was like, I can't read his book. Like, it's just going to make me mad because I can't write as good as him. And so, you know, I know that sounds like I'm cheating. Like, oh, he didn't even read.
No, lots of people say that. Lots of people say that they don't read while they're writing, or if they do read, they only read things that they've already read before. So, like, a lot of people say, like, they'll reread Sula by Toni Morrison, or people will say, like, I didn't read anything while I was writing because I didn't want anything to, like, get in the way, or maybe I read essays, or so you're not alone in that. It's common that people don't read.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just wanted to say that, like, I had a big old stack that I'm getting through now, but I didn't want to be psyched out. And as far as stuff that I was watching, again, I didn't want to take in too much stimuli because inadvertently, by taking in all this different stimuli, their voice becomes yours. Mm. And I never want to disrespect anybody that I know or anybody that I revere by inadvertently taking their thoughts and making them my own in the book. And so I hope I did a pretty good job of just getting away and writing my own thing and catching up on that stuff after I turned in the book in September 2019.
Right. Okay. And so when you're writing, how do you like to write? How many hours a day? How often do you, you said you have music on. So you have music on while you're writing. Are you at home? Are you in a cafe if it's not a pandemic? Most importantly, do you have snacks or beverages, rituals, like kind of set the scene for your writing?
Absolutely. I try to set office hours for myself. And okay. So when I first started writing the book, I was still in Brooklyn, New York. And I made it a point every day to be, I live over here by Pratt Institute. And so I would make it a point to be at the library every day by 9 a.m. with my coffee, with my little, a bagel sandwich. Obviously, I wouldn't eat that every day because that can go left really quickly. So, I would be there by 9 o'clock and I would dedicate the first 2 hours of my day to just writing as much as I could and writing slowly and not rushing out the words. And so I had a goal every day of writing 1,000 words a day. I wasn't going to go above that. I wasn't going to go below that. So I would write from Pratt for like 9 to 11. And then I would on purpose make it a point to walk way down into Fort Greene and go to Green Grape, which is a cafe that has since closed because of the pandemic. Okay. And I would work from there for another 2-3 hours. And like every writer, it seems, I had my little coffee in every place. I get a small and I would just, dedicate just time to a chapter a day. So it was important for me to not write 12 hours and 13 hours because I'm a happily married person. And so I wanted to make sure I remain human, so I would write from 9 a.m. to about 5, maybe 6 if I was pushing it. If I was getting closer to the deadline, I would go till 6 o'clock. And so I would do that every day. So then by the time my writing was over, I could come in here, cook dinner, or I could, still just be a human being, watch the game, watch Kawhi Leonard, I can watch the finals and stuff like that. But the second part of the answer, and then I'll wrap it up, in between time, after I got the deal and I was writing the book, my wife and I also got a place in Nairobi, Kenya, in East Africa. And so about 60% of the book was written from there, from a co-working space called Ikigai. And it was the same deal where I would make sure I was out of the apartment by like 8 or 9. I would write until about 5. Then I would go back to the apartment. And because it was 7 and 8 hours ahead of New York, I felt like I could still get all my writing in before my email starts lighting up in the evening. So that was my process.
And why did you guys get a place in Nairobi? What was that about?
Yeah, that was my wife's doing. I still remember it. It was September 2018. I was in here working. I think I was working on like chapter 1 of the book. And she had gone to Nairobi for work. She had a few conferences that she was conducting. And she comes back in here and I'd never seen her eyes that wide before. She was just like, "What do you think about moving to Nairobi, Kenya? It is the next wave. It is amazing. It's great." And it was like a 5-minute conversation because at the time I knew I was going to have to leave Bandcamp. At the time I was there full time as a senior editor, and there was no way I could do all of I couldn't fulfill my responsibilities at Bandcamp and write this book, because it was mad important. So I knew I was leaving, so I was like, "Well, as long as Nairobi has Wi-Fi, I'm good." And so it was her, and she was launching a business. She launched a business called Live Africa, And she was like, well, I can't launch a business called Live Africa if I don't live in Africa.
Right.
And she's her folks are West African. She's originally from, her parents are from Sierra Leone. My wife, Mabinti's from D.C. And so we just lived on the, we just decided to go to the continent. And that's why, if you noticed in the book, there are a few different places where I talk from a personal standpoint about what it's like to land and to be in the continent and to sort of talk to the local people there. And it's solely from living in Nairobi, Kenya. People don't talk about Nairobi as a destination, but it's amazing.
Wow. And are you, you're back in the States now. Is that because of the pandemic?
No, well, indirectly.
This is like sort of becoming a personal interview. Sorry, I'm just really curious.
No, you can ask any questions you want. Ask any questions you want. No, we're back because, one, it was book promotion time. Secondly, because of the pandemic, we hadn't seen our family since like March. Mm. And so, you know, when you have parents who are a little bit older, that time, you know, the time that you spend with them is more important. And so we came back and we're going to be here through the holidays. So it's, you know, a couple of different reasons why we're back in Brooklyn. Plus we just love Brooklyn. So,
right. So you are kind of live in two places, basically. You're not bi-coastal, mm-hmm. You're bi-continental.
Yeah, which is challenging, but yeah. it's a blessing too. But yep, that's our deal right now.
That's so cool. I love that. Okay, I'm going to get back to talking about your book, though I probably could spend a whole another like hour to asking you about Nairobi, but we'll pretend like we're on track today. What other musical artists would you want to write a book about?
Ooh, well, book number two is about De La Soul.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's book number two. I'm right. It's called High and Rising after their, you know, their debut album, 3 Feet High and Rising. And it's coming out on HMH Books.
Okay.
2022. But honestly, you know, a little inside baseball. Initially, I wanted book number two to be about Pharoah Sanders, this jazz legend.
Okay.
Jazz legend. He, you know, just a super quick, story. He was at the forefront of spiritual jazz and free jazz in the late 60s and early 70s, indirectly, because there was this holy trinity of like saxophonists. It was him, Albert Eiler, and John Coltrane. Both John and Albert pass away much too soon. And that all of a sudden, Pharoah's at the forefront. And as he's trying to get his music off the ground, here in this other cafe in Greenwich Village is this young kid named Bob Dylan who's trying to get his music off the ground too. And so that's the story that I wanted to tell. And hopefully it can be book number three. If any publisher is listening, that would be great. but no, I would love to also write about Stevie Wonder. I would love to write a book about Alice Coltrane, about Minnie Riperton, and Yasiin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def. I would love to write those books.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I feel like I should ask you this. This was not on my list, but again, another personal question from me.
Sure.
I am not a jazz listener, but that's not because it's because I don't know anything about jazz. So it's not like I have anything against jazz music. I just am, you know, a Luddite or whatever. And I like hip hop. I like pop music. So I want you to maybe recommend to me and other people like me a great album or two to start kind of dipping my feet into jazz. Nothing too difficult to listen to. Something that you're like, this would be great for someone like you. I know you don't know all my music tastes. I love Beyonce.
Yeah.
Rihanna.
They're great. I mean, they're amazing. I love them too. They're amazing. So I get it. But as far as like what's a good jazz album that's, I would say, Herbie Hancock's Mwandishi album. It's Swahili for creator. Okay. It came out in, I want to say, 1971. It's very meditative and it's very, I don't know, it's very pondering in a way. At the time, it didn't sell well because jazz had been transitioning to this, like, you know, brighter strain of like funk. And it's a little spacey, but it's not so spacey where you can't get what's going on. It's one of those records where you're into books, like play it in the background while you're reading and it doesn't get in the way of what you're trying to absorb. Other than that, something more recent, I would definitely say Nabiah Garcia's Source album. Okay. Because it's technically jazz, but it gets into some reggae, some dub. It gets into some pop music. So those are the two I say start with.
Okay, good. I'm gonna like DM you and be like, okay, I listened, and this is what I think. I need more like this or more like that. I feel like I should listen to jazz. I feel like it's people who listen to it love it, and it's important music to the culture, but I just don't know anything. I wasn't raised on it, you know? I feel like music is one of those things, mostly whatever you're raised on. And then eventually, if you decide to get a life partner or get married or something, whatever they were raised on. Like, I never listened to Paul Simon in my whole life. And now I'm like kind of a Paul Simon fan because my husband is like really into him. But like, I feel like aside from whatever your parents introduce you to, it's sort of like, you listen to whatever your parents introduce you to, whatever you kind of think is great when you're in middle school, and then like whatever your partner later in life or whatever introduces you to. But it's hard to get into something that is not introduced to you by someone who knows. So I feel like since you're someone who knows about jazz, I'm going to let you introduce me to something.
No pressure.
Okay, this is a really important question. What is a word that you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh man, inconvenience.
Ooh.
Inconvenience kills me every time.
Impossible.
I type it and I always get the red squiggly line underneath it every time. It never fails.
I cannot spell that word either, which should surprise exactly zero people. Okay, this is sort of similar to my jazz question. What's some new and exciting music that you're really loving that you think people should be checking out because maybe in a few years they might be winning the Pulitzer Prize too, or they might be the book that you write, your seventh book or something?
I got to tell you, there is this underground movement of hip-hop / soul artists / producers. They are all moving in the same circle, and they're all creating great records. Off the top of my head, Pink Sifu, this guy named Mike in all capital letters, M-I-K-E. You have Fly Anakin. You have Nelson Bandana. You have Kaya. You have Liv. They all run in the same circles, and they all create this very meditative strain of rap and soul that's rooted, it's rooted in Black plight, and it's rooted in very isolated themes like depression and you know, just trying to figure out how to, where the next meal is coming from, stuff like that. But they somehow find a way to spin it forward into something positive and something forward looking. And I would also add to that, like Akai Solo is another one, and Mobby, like, and they're all sort of in the school of Earl Sweatshirt, where Earl was doing that before everybody, and before him it was Jeremiah J that was doing all of the, you know, they were creating the same kind of music, but they've somehow made it a movement. Couple that with the fact that you have this really brilliant director / writer named Terrence Nance, who was the creator of Random Acts of Flyness on HBO. And it's all, they all sort of move in the similar pack of, you know, unapologetic Black art that I feel like more people need to know about. And I feel like it's the next wave. So that's what I'm really into right now. It's that whole collective. And Standing on the Corner is another one. And Sloss and Malone, like all of these people, like the records are similar, but they all tell a very, very robust story that I feel like more folks need to be into.
Ooh, I'm so excited. I'm about to go nuts on my Spotify. Okay. For people who love The Butterfly Effect, they've read it, they think it's great. What other books might you recommend to them? Not necessarily about Kendrick Lamar, but kind of in the same vein, or maybe things that are in conversation with your work.
Mm-hmm. I would say people want to check out Empire State of Mind, which is a like-minded culture biography of Jay-Z. They came out years ago. I would also recommend, I mentioned it before, but Hanif's A Tribe Called Quest book called Notes to a Tribe Called Quest. There is a book on Dapper Dan called, you know, it's that's a memoir, but it's brilliant. Like, okay. The Dapper Dan book is great. So I would stick with those. Those are like in close alignment.
I love that. I'm going to ask you a question that is probably not even going to be relevant when this episode comes out, but I'm curious your take on it. in the last week or so, we've seen a lot of rap musicians come out and endorse Donald Trump. And I'm just curious if you have thoughts about that. I'm curious about them.
You know, here's where I sound like the jaded journalist. I'm not surprised. Like, sure. the thing that surprises me is, you know, when you're on Twitter and you're scrolling and all of these people are fake shocked by these famous people doing crazy things. Right. Like, it happens all the time. It's been happening all the time. So whether it's Ice Cube, whether it's Lil Wayne, Kanye West, there's nothing that any of these people can do that will surprise me. Like, mm-hmm. I think we need to start doing more to separate art from the person. Sure. We can still listen to the Lil Wayne mixtapes. We can still listen to N.W.A. We can still listen to Dark Twisted Fantasy and all of this. Kanye's Dark Twisted Fantasy, and still enjoy the music, but then not be shocked when they come out as, you know, supporting Trump. Like, I put no stock in these people in that regard. That's none of my business.
Right. So I agree with you as someone who consumes a lot of art and at one point would say that I was an artist, that the art and the artist are separate. And, you know, I studied theater in school and we studied a lot of crazy artists who made really great work. But for me, I can turn it on, but I can't enjoy it anymore. Are you able to still enjoy the music knowing what you know about the artist? Because it's not that I'm like, oh, I can't, like, I won't listen to it. It's like, I put it on, then I'm like, ugh, Kanye, get out of here. You're so annoying right now. I can't stand you. Why are you on my ballot? Like, get out of here.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's totally fair. It takes me a while. It definitely takes me a while. It's not one of those things where I can, like, even yesterday, like, oh, wow, Lil Wayne took a picture with Donald Trump. Let me go play a Lil Wayne mixtape. Right. Like, I can't do it. I have to step away from it. But once I step away and I go back, like I even did that with Kanye, you know, when he was going through, I guess, well, it can only be described as a public meltdown.
Right.
But then I would go back and I would play Runaway from, like, Dark Twisted Fantasy. I would play, like, Late Registration. And I'm like, man, where is this guy? Like, yeah. Where is that guy?
Yeah.
And so I listened to it in that regard, but I definitely have to step back from it. And then it doesn't affect me when I listen to it, like, months later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like when this episode comes out, my Dark Twisted Fantasy will have just turned 10 years old, which is so crazy. Because it's November 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's such an incredible album. And it's so annoying that he sucks now. It's like, can you just not suck so that we can all just, like, bop for of the same? Like, we can all collectively just enjoy Monster again? Like,
right.
Why are you taking this away from Nicki Minaj? Okay. Why are you taking away one of her greatest verses? Because you're a freaking nightmare. But anyways, that's just me being mad at Kanye. Okay. I have two more questions for you. One is, who is the coolest person who's expressed interest or excitement in your book / have you heard from Kendrick or TD since the book came out?
Oh, okay. First question. The coolest person that's expressed interest since it's come out?
Yeah, like the coolest person that you know who's read it, or like you saw someone tweeted like, yo, this book is great. Like, is there anybody that excites you in that way?
Yeah, well, I would say it's sort of a two-headed monster. Terrace Martin and Robert Glasper. I did a talk with them not too long ago, and I was nervous. Like, when the book came out, I was incredibly nervous because even though I know it's super positive, I know that it's the first book on Kendrick ever. And so that naturally comes with a bit of skepticism. Mm. Yeah. And now that people are getting their hands on it and they're reading it, they're like, oh, okay. All right, cool. Marcus is cool again. You know, that kind of thing. So like Terrace and Robert are super enthusiastic about it. And they've been, like, really supportive. Kendrick and TDE definitely have the book. I have not heard from them yet, but I also realize that, again, they're in album mode. They stay in album mode. And so, quite frankly, I'm preparing to, like, not hear anything ever, because that's just how they operate. So I'd be shocked if I heard something in a positive way. So, you know, I just have to move forward with the next projects. And if they're down with it and they want to shout it out, or if they want to hit me up privately, amazing. But I also realize it's not a requirement because they really have no reason to.
Right, right. Okay, last question. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read The Butterfly Effect, who would you want it to be?
I would want it to be my grandmother, because she was a hero of mine and she passed away in 97. And I'm pretty sure, I mean, her spirit is still here. I know it is. But I wish she was around to actually see all of the love, because she was a big musical influence on me as well. You know, whether it was her gospel music, whether it was her loving Elton John, you know, she loved all kinds of music, and it showed me as a young Black kid that good music is good music. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And so if there was a way for her to read it, I would love to like hear her thoughts on it.
That's so nice. I love that. I also think that older Black folks love Elton John.
They are here for Elton, yo.
My dad loved Elton John. My dad was like big Elton John, big. And he was an older Black man. So I feel like anecdotally hearing your grandmother and my dad, I'm like, oh, all older Black people love Elton John.
They love it. 80s Elton, please.
So, I mean, please. Bops. Bops on top of bops.
All day. I still play it. I play it all day, every day.
Yeah, I love Elton John. I have 10-month-old twins, and my husband and I are doing a project where every Sunday we introduce them to a new iconic album, according to us. We've already done Yellow Brick Road. It was very important. We're saving My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy till the 10-year anniversary. And we did Thriller, which was really, we were torn about Thriller for the week of Halloween, but we felt like, you know, separate the artist from the art. But we also have done, you know, Celine Dion, iconic, Falling Into You, you know, Spice Girls was iconic for me, so we did that.
I ain't mad at none of it. If it's good music, it's good music. I hear that.
That's right. Well, this has been such a treat talking to you. Everybody at home, if you have not picked up the book yet, you still have time. We will be discussing it next week, November 25th, with Cole Kushner. The book is The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. I also encourage you, if you have read the book but you want a little bit more, definitely check out Dissect. Check out Cole's seasons of both To Pimp a Butterfly and Damn. They're super interesting. They give a different but very complimentary insight into the work. You know, much more musical because it's a podcast, but it really, listening to those episodes and reading the book kind of concurrently really informed my understanding of the work. So I encourage you all to do both of those things. Marcus, thank you so much for joining me today.
No, thank you. It's been great. I really appreciate it.
This is such a treat. And everyone at home, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you to Marcus for being our guest today, and thank you to David Brown at Simon & Schuster for helping us set up this interview. Don't forget, our book club pick for November is The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America by Marcus J. Moore, which we will discuss on November 25th with Cole Kushner. And be sure to head to thestackspodcast.com/shop to check out our brand new merch. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to rate and review the show. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and thestackspodcast.com. Today's episode is edited and produced by Sebastian Alcala. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.